It's time
for a solid hour of Tea Party Power.
And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Good morning and welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. We are very excited today to have Mary Beth Hicks with us. She is a weekly columnist for the Washington Times, the editor of the e-newsletter Family Events, and she is a guest on many radio and television stations across the country. She's also a regular speaker across the country. She has written two bestsellers, including Bringing Up Geeks, How to Protect Your Kids' Childhood in a Grow-Up-Too-Fast World, and The Perfect World Inside My Minivan, One Mom's Journey Through the Streets of Suburbia. But she's here today to talk to us about her new book, Don't Let the Kids Drink the Kool-Aid. Mary Beth, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be with you.
Oh, we are very excited to have you here today, as I said. Now, if you don't mind, I want to start in the back of your book and work forward, because there's something at the very end of this book that really got me fired up, and it's the chapter 9, Restoring America and the Next Generation. And you give some really great examples of just how extreme things have gotten in the classroom, and I tell you what, I'll let you list a few of those for us.
Well, you know, it's kind of a nice thing that you started at the back of the book. Most people start at the front, and I have to be honest with you, the book is meant to be pretty alarming, and it is. And so I've had my editor send me an email about halfway through I was writing it. She said, "You are writing a very scary book." But the end does have some positive things that parents can do and families can do to kind of regroup. You know, there's stories about a little guy who was 7-year-old who was assigned to draw a picture of what Christmas meant to him, and he drew a picture, a stick figure of Jesus on the cross. And he was sent home from school because the teacher said he had drawn a violent image and they needed to have him psychologically tested at the parents' expense. So, you know, so of course, you know, he was tested. He was fine. He was found to be fine and was able to go back to school. But, you know, those are some examples of a teacher who had to have he had God Bless America hanging in his classroom. He was a social studies teacher. For 20 years he had the sign in his classroom, and the district came in and told him he had to take it down. And, you know, there's just all kinds of ways in which students and teachers are kind of being hamstrung in the classroom for being patriotic or for speaking their mind. And, and those are just some of the examples. But really the premise of the book is that leftism has just really permeated all of the places where our children go, or our children are. So it's the schools, media, pop culture, and those places are so dominated by the left that our kids' generation is really being saturated with leftist messages, and it's very difficult to raise them with any sort of balance or raise them to understand traditional American values.
Well, what's interesting is that the political correctness doesn't seem to apply to everybody. For example, if the little boy had drawn a picture of Osama bin Laden shooting an infidel, I think they would have argued that that's okay. And if instead of God Bless America, the sign said Allah Bless America, I think if anyone tried to take it down, there would have been hell to pay for it, and everybody would have been screaming that they were violating the rights of the young Muslim children. So the political correctness only seems to it seems to extend to just about everyone except conservatives and Christians. So I'm frustrated with it. But what age does this start? Does this start in kindergarten?
You know, I got to tell you, it starts even sooner than that. When I kind of dissect the fact that it's in schools, it's in the media, and it's in pop culture, I kind of go into the whole idea of what's happening in media with different attitudes and different messages, and it's all the way down to Sesame Street, Mark. And I have to say that now I'm going to be like that weird conservative mom who doesn't like Sesame Street. Not true. Loved Sesame Street. My kids watched it. I don't know how any mom could ever get a shower when her kids are little, if she doesn't let her kids watch Sesame Street, because it's a, you know, can have great little messages and whatnot. And when Sesame Street began, the mission of that show was to teach poor kids numeracy and literacy so that they'd be ready for school. And it had a great mission about really kind of using television in a really positive way in that way. But if you go online to the Sesame Workshop website now, you'll see that their mission literally has expanded to promoting the idea of global citizenship. I mean, they actually use the words global citizen to small children and teaching diversity and multiculturalism in ways that help American children understand the just distribution of resources is important. That's on their website. And, you know, so it's really important. But when they have Sesame Street all over the world, and when they start Sesame Street shows in other countries, that's not their mission. Their mission is to promote, for example, in Indonesia, their mission was to promote a national unity of Indonesia, national character. So in America, though, we don't want to have a national character. They want us to have global citizenship and not be the big, bad monster America. So, you know, it's just crazy how it's out there for even little kids. And so that when by the time kids grow up and they're getting to be school age, they're getting to be young adults, now we can see it has worked. It's working. They are demonstrably leftist in their worldview, not just in that sort of Churchillian way that, you know, if you're not a liberal when you're young, you know, you have your heart, and if you're not a conservative when you're old, you have no brain, nothing like that.
Right.
I mean, they really don't get what America is about, what it's for, how it started, what our economic system is. They don't get that free market capitalism is the best way to freedom and prosperity for all people. They just don't get that, and it's because the left is winning.
Well, there are entire high schools run by La Raza where they actually teach the kids that America is a very bad place.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a high school in New York City. I used an example out of that one in the book. It's called the Social Justice High School. There is such a thing. And where they teach social justice math. And you can, you know, where they sit kids down and they devise a problem that they want to solve, whether it's sweatshop labor or it's unfair housing, or, you know, they pick a project, a topic that they want to discuss, and they discuss how it's unfair. And then they apparently apply some mathematic principles to it. When I read the description that the teacher put out there, it says, some days if you need to work on the math, you could take a day and do a worksheet. But, you know, really try and stay focused on the subject. I'm like, you know, and we wonder why our kids are not competitive in math and science. I mean, that is just crazy. But actually, it makes a ton of sense to me. I've always been confused about why America, greatest nation on the earth, cannot be the top of the heap in schools. That seems like something we used to be, certainly, and it seems like something we ought to be. But then when you go and you look at who is teaching the teachers, what are our teachers' colleges like, then it all starts to make sense. Then you understand that no amount of money you throw in a classroom will solve the problem, because the problem is ideology. And, you know, like Bill Ayers, before he was hosting a coffee clutch for Barack Obama, was off becoming the guru of teacher education. He is one of the gurus in our nation. He goes all over the country. He's just retired from permanent teaching, but he still goes all over the country, speaks to teachers' colleges, speaks to students up and coming, and he believes that the purpose of education is the doing of social justice. And so he doesn't think that even teachers have to be experts in their field. He thinks that's unnecessary, because the purpose of teaching really is the touchy-feely kind of get people talking. It's not really get people learning. And so, that's the philosophy behind our teaching, and that's why our teaching isn't getting it done.
Well, the Chicago Annenberg Challenge just did wonders for the test scores in Chicago. Yeah,
it's like you can point to so many examples of this kind of stuff that obviously doesn't work. And the examples that do work are like the Harlem Promise Academy, where they just take kids in Harlem, it doesn't matter if they're urban kids or suburban kids, if you apply the principles of old-fashioned teaching, where you make sure every student is understanding the material, they will soar. And so it's really, I mean, talk about shortchanging the minority population in urban communities. It's a horrible way to shortchange them, because they need great education more than anybody. And yet it's just, you know, it's a place where they can do social justice. So that's what they're doing.
Well, one of the first things Barack Obama did when he hit Washington was try to eliminate a voucher program that had been a great benefit to young African-American students. So I guess I don't know if he didn't want everyday African-Americans attending the same private school as his daughters or what his problem was. But I think there was enough noise raised about that there were actually African-Americans protesting on the White House lawn. That wasn't good for publicity. So he agreed to grandfather in everybody that was already in the program, but they're not taking any more new students, as I understand it. And I think that is absolutely disgusting, and a great example of how the Democratic Party is not the party that is looking out for the best interest of the young African Americans. Now, it's part of the approach, and let's give the Democrats credit. They are very, very patient. I mean, if this takes them 100, 200 years, they're content to wait that time, but they're smart enough to start with the kids and work up. But it seems like a big part of the process is dumbing down the education. Kids don't know a lot of the things that they used to know about the founding fathers, about the Constitution, about math and science. Am I overstating it, or is our education being dumbed down at this point?
No, No, it's demonstrably so, and I talk about that just quite a bit in the book. And the book is really, I mean, I should say that, you know, the Kool-Aid that I'm talking about is the pervasive philosophy message of leftism, and it's being disseminated in just every place where kids are. But in the schools, obviously, is the place where they just have so much contact with educators who have an agenda. And so what we see is that our kids are statistically, they don't know their civics, they don't know economics. About 5% drop in the high school kids who are exposed to the Constitution and civics between 2006 and 2010. 5% fewer high school seniors report studying the Constitution over those, you know, in the span of those years, which means that just in time for them to go out and rock the vote, you know, they don't even know what we are. If you go down the street, you ask any kid in America, what kind of government do we have? They will tell you, we have a democracy. And if you say, well, actually, we have democratic values, but what we have is a democratically elected constitutional republic, they will look at you like a deer in the headlights. They have no clue. And, you know, but that's important, you know? I mean, it's really important that we know. I mean, John Adams wrote to Abigail in a letter once, you know, children must be educated and instructed in the principles of liberty. And they can't have the kind of country that our founders created for them and left for posterity, which would be them, you know, unless we have some of the kinds of people that did that and that understood those values and were cherishing values of liberty and freedom. And so, you know, it's just so incumbent on us parents to counter these messages that kids are getting in the classroom. The way I kind of viewed it was this, Mark. If you consider that America is like this three-legged stool, sits on top of three things, faith, family, and freedom. The left is kind of undercutting the stool so that kids really have a very different idea of what family is all about. They really are losing their faith and losing an understanding of the importance of God in their life and in civic life. And, of course, they don't really understand how freedom works and how you keep it, you know. And so they get rid of those old-fashioned ideas in the minds of kids, and then they come in with the new stuff, with the eco-radicalism and hypersexual culture and the gay agenda and the nanny state ideas. And so on the one hand, they sort of empty the bucket, and then they're filling it up with something else entirely. And because they can do it through the schools, through the entertainment media, through pop culture, they have all these ways to access kids. And so consequently, they just have very, very different ideas about what America is all about.
One of the stories that I like to tell on the show, Mary Beth, is a story of a young lady I was talking to one day, and I mentioned the word communism. And this was a young lady who made very good grades in high school and made very good grades in college. And she hadn't been out of college that long, but she said, okay, communism, that's the bad one, right?
Oh, geez.
Okay, and this was a young lady who made good grades, and we really can't fault her because in all her years of education, she was never even taught the difference between communism and capitalism.
Well, which is kind of weird, only in that my experience is a little bit different. I have two daughters one is already out of college, one's a junior in college. And for both of those girls, as they approached college in their freshman year, one of the first things they were assigned to read was the Communist Manifesto. And so maybe it depends where you go, but we probably paid extra for that. You know, but you only read, like, the Federalist Papers or even the Constitution if you take a class for that. The Communist Manifesto actually is included in some of those core curriculum courses about modernity and all that sort of thing. But
I guess the context was that it was a good thing.
You know, it's just nothing's all bad, I think, is what they're always being taught. There's nothing's all bad or all good. It's just relative, you know. But, you know, but those kinds of things, it's really interesting what passes for curriculum now that is stuff that's just really, truly propaganda. I mean, my daughter, I have four children, and so two, you know, one in college, I have two in high school now. So my daughter, when last year she was in the eighth grade, she had to watch in her science class a film called The Human Footprint, which is something National Geographic put out. It's this graphic depiction. They use a lot of these, I don't know, they call them like visual events or something, to try and demonstrate to you how much stuff you're using in your life. So they take 4,000 loaves of bread and they put it in a picture, and you're supposed to see, wow, that's a heck of a lot of bread. And so, but the And it's meant to talk about consumerism and I don't know, conservation of resources. But really, the thing should have been called the Big, Bad, Evil American Anti-Capitalist Footprint, because that is what the movie was really all about. And we hadn't really heard of it, so of course I went online, I'm researching it, I'm trying to figure it out. I go to the teacher's materials that you can find online for it. Of course, one of the things it advocates is population control. By the way, did I mention my daughter went to a Catholic school? So I'm thinking, why is my Catholic school sending my kid down for something that's ultimately advocating population control? Very strange. So, but this is the sort of stuff that our kids are getting as curriculum, as material, as truth, as research. And so it's incumbent on parents and grandparents and anybody who has contact with kids to know enough so you can combat these things, because otherwise these kids are just swallowing it hook, line, and sinker.
Well, as far as the Catholic school is concerned, I went to Catholic school until eighth grade, and my son went kindergarten through his senior year of high school and is now at a major university. And I guess they would argue that you can control the population through abstinence or,
sure,
methods like rhythm. So I don't think they were ready to hand out condoms yet, probably. which, by the way, you point out in the book that there was some place where they extended the condom distribution program to elementary school.
Hey, heck, don't leave the middle schoolers out. Absolutely. Yes, very small school district where they, up in the Northeast, where they decided to extend their condom policy down to their elementary grade, because the elementary grade went up to the sixth grade or something, fifth grade. But so it had the same policies as it did in the high school, which means that reproductive counseling, as they call it, is a complete privacy policy. So you can't, you could give kids condoms. You needed to talk to them if they knew how to use them. You need to instruct them on some of their other options. For example, abstinence was one, but you didn't have to tell the parents that kids were coming and looking for these things. And, in fact, you couldn't tell the parents. But, of course, you'd probably have to call the parents if they came down and you wanted to administer a Band-Aid, but you can't call the parents and say,
sure,
hey, your kids just stopped into my office and they want a condom. You might want to know about that. So, but it's that's just one of the ways that they undercut parental authority, which is a big piece of this. And a very important piece. One of the things I do at the end of the book when people say, what can we do, is I'm really telling people, if you want to combat the Kool-Aid, you have to have authority in your home. And they are chipping away at it little by little. And with I'm sure you guys and Tea Party people are the people who know about the UN's Convention on the Rights of the Child. And, that's coming our way if we're not careful. The leftists really feel it's something we should sign off on. And so parentalauthority.org is a great organization for people to know about and to visit and to be involved in, because I actually do think that we should have a parental rights amendment to the Constitution, because so many cases of it, of parents' rights being undermined when they're simply trying to be good parents to their children.
And why do I feel that those children's rights that they're talking about don't extend to unborn children?
Oh, gosh, don't be silly. Yeah, of course not. Yeah, of course not, Mark. But they do extend to the sexuality of children. And so Planned Parenthood International actually promotes something called the Sexual Rights of Children. And just 2 days ago, I see that our Health and Human Services website for the federal government does basically adopt and promote the provisions of that little manifesto on its website. So if you want to go to the government webpage that says, I have, questions about my sexuality, there's all this happy talk from HHS about how children are sexual beings. And we need to recognize that children from infancy are sexual beings, and then we can support them in their emerging sexuality. And sometimes that means questioning sexuality. So we have to recognize that kids, sometimes they want, it's normal and natural to go through life wondering what your sexuality is all about, whether you're heterosexual, homosexual, and it might change in your life, because now we have something called sexual fluidity. And these are the reasons why we teach sexuality education and not sex education in schools now. That's what they want to teach in schools. So this is all in the book. This is all the Kool-Aid I'm talking about. And parents and grandparents and concerned citizens need to know this stuff, because otherwise we are operating without knowing what's really happening. And because I tell people these stories and they go, no, there's no way that's happening. I can't believe that. And that's how I felt when I first started researching. But you have to believe it. You have to know what's out there. And otherwise, we're just not going to be as effective as we can be, both in our own homes and publicly, as we're trying to, uphold the American values that we all share.
If we can go back to the example of the kid who would want to get a condom from the school nurse and would have no problem getting it without the parents finding out, but would probably be called if the child asked for an aspirin, I think it goes much farther than that. I think if the child said, hey, I'm pregnant, you know, if you have a 13-year-old girl or 14-year-old girl who's pregnant, I'm sure that the school nurse would probably help her arrange an abortion or give her information on where she could get one without telling the parents, but once again, couldn't give the kid an aspirin without calling the parents. I mean, the whole thing
that's actually happened, yeah. That's actually happened. It happened in a state, and it happened illegally in a state, I think it was New Jersey, but in a state where there was a parental provision law that parents had to be notified about abortion, and so the school nurse counselor helped the student to go to a neighboring state where it was not required. And so that one resulted in a lawsuit and undermining the rights of the parents. But, you know, I mean, I've had kids who have, you know, had surgery. They had their tonsils out. They had their ear surgery. Or surgery is surgery. If your child is going into any kind of medical procedure, it is unconscionable to me that anybody would put a finger on a child without having their parents in the next room. But that is how successful the left has been. And we need to, like, wake up and realize how serious that is. Because, you know, that's a slippery slope that can almost at this point, I wonder how we can get it back. I know a lot of states really try to regroup and impose the, you know, the parental notification law. And it seems like it should be a no-brainer. But so much of this does. And then you look at it and you realize, man, are they winning? So kids really, but then the thing that really bothers me is it working? Yeah, it's working. So now we know that Rasmussen last year did a poll of young adults under age 30, and 36 or 37% of them favored capitalism as a system, but 33% favored socialism, and about 30% had no idea. And so you're looking at about two-thirds of young adults who don't know or understand why capitalism is the best system for a free and prosperous society. And, you know, they've gone to Europe and study abroad, and you know, they go to France and they think it's great, and you know, so they don't have any experience of socialism being anything but, you know, free stuff when they go to Europe, and it's very scary.
You've mentioned the eco-radicalism a couple of times. I actually put up a site called greenbullies.com just so parents could get an idea of just what types of measures were being taken to scare children into believing in anthropogenic global warming. And it's amazing to me that when the left can't convince children to believe in something, their next tactic is to scare them into believing in it. The Build-A-Bear people put out a film where they said, you know, if we don't do something about global warming, there's not going to be enough snow for Santa's sled to take off. There was a picture in a leftist magazine of a little girl standing on a block of ice with a noose around her neck. The message was very clear: if we don't do something about global warming, the ice is going to melt and the little girl is going to die. And then the worst of all, the most offensive case, was a group that put out a series of films, and in one of them a teacher was asking the kids, do you think you can do something about global warming? And two of the kids didn't raise their hand and agree, so the teacher pressed a button and blew them up, and it was a very, very graphic scene. I mean, huge chunks of bloody human flesh slapping down on the desks, and you know, to the horror of the other school children
in the
classroom. And if you haven't had a chance to see that, you might want to go to greenbullies.com and check it out. In fact, I believe it's Gillian Anderson from The X-Files was actually the narrator in that, and actually gets blown up at the end of the series herself. But then again, she's the same person that tried to warn everybody that the world was going to hell because of Y2K, so her track record isn't that good. But that's the level of extremism that they will go to. Now, you mentioned the Footprint film. Did your kids get forced to watch An Inconvenient Truth as well?
Yeah, my son did. My son did in the same science curriculum a couple of years earlier. And then I guess, you know, just to update things rather than use that one again, they found this one. So, yeah, and it is, I mean, one of the studies I found online was one that was done by an eco-friendly website for children in which they said that, you know, like a third of children who are 5 years old or younger or something, you know, elementary school age kids, I guess it was, think that the Earth won't exist when they grow up.
Right.
They already think it won't exist. So you're right, the scare tactic stuff is working. Also, it's embedded everywhere. So not only would they get this in like a classroom situation and a science as their curriculum, as fact and what you're learning, but then you go online and you'd go on Nickelodeon.com or Disney.com and you want to be part of the big help, right? You're little and you know, that looks fun and you can point and click and you can be part of that online community. So I went and I joined the big help because I wanted to be a big helper, right? So I go and see, and the ways in which you become a big helper. First of all, they're just gratuitously silly. You know, you can save the planet by cleaning the lint from your dryer. You might save your house fire, but I just don't see, you know, so some of these things were just like so silly. I mean, you know, you had to go figure out how to, you know, you could get points and win the game and become a bigger and bigger helper if you figured out how to change to the other kind of light bulbs, to the new light bulbs, fluorescent, and basically the way to do it is ask a parent. You know, so it was like, but you got points for that. So, but then what I found was that
new light bulbs that are so dangerous for the environment that
right.
if you drop one, the Kerry Boxer bill had 6 pages of instructions on how you
and how to dispose of it. Yep, yep, those would be the ones. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but then what's scary is too. So then, in order, then they want you to meet their eco-friendly friends through this website. So they direct kids to other websites of organizations that they can become affiliated with, supporting, know about. And what are they? Things like World Wildlife Fund and, you know, all these places that are, you know, learn about the oil spill down in the Gulf. And then they click you to that one, and it's all this information for kids about what happened? Who was in charge? Who was at fault for the oil spill? And I love this one. Well, in a sense, we're all at fault because
yeah.
we are so dependent on oil and fossil fuels. And so, of course, really, you little kid, you're actually part of the reason that there was an oil spill. And, you know, it's just nonsense. It's unbelievable. But it's so out there and it's so pervasive. You think your child is just playing games on Nickelodeon. Look twice. The stuff there is just so pervasive. And so we have to know. And I've already been accused this week, when the book came out on Tuesday, of being a paranoid person. And, you know, I think just because it's happening doesn't mean I'm paranoid.
Right.
And I think
just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're really not out to get you.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I'm not paranoid. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't think there's, you know, George Soros is calling a meeting with everybody from the teachers to the producers of Family Guy and, you know, making a game plan. I just think it's everywhere, and we weren't paying attention to as well as we should have to the fact that the left was attracting people who wanted to be teaching. The left attracts all the people in the media. The rest of us were all just kind of going home, raising our own families, you know, working in the garden in the back, coaching the peewee games, and kind of didn't notice that other people chose avenues of career that would enable them to indoctrinate children. And so now what you have, in my view, is the potential for the first generation of American socialists, because they are so fully indoctrinated that if we don't start to right the ship, they will just simply not have the opportunity for the free society that they should, because they will be inclined to give up their freedom for securities. That's what they've always known. That's what they've always thought was right. And so, but I think what we'll see is, you know, the London Rioter kids, you know, you saw some of the images of that, but also the interviews and listening
sure.
to some of these kids. First, the ignorance was just unbelievable. It was
absolutely.
Like astonishing that people could be that ignorant. But
it's like it's all the rich people's fault.
Yeah, exactly. And then my favorite one, I swear, it was this guy he's a reporter who lived in the neighborhood that was being trashed. So he was very concerned. He ran downstairs with his camera. He said, "We live here. Why are you doing this to our neighborhood?" And the girl says, "I'm getting my taxes back." And he's like astonished. He's like, "You don't pay any taxes. How could you get your taxes back from the appliance store? You know, like, that makes no sense." But they're just, but that's what we're headed for, because we are also following the path of raising a generation that feels entitled, they're coddled, everything's done for them. We're not raising them up to strive for independence. We're raising them up to feel dependent. And, you know, Barack Obama announced to Arcadia College students that when he was going to extend the health care till they're 26. And instead of thinking, "Wow, dude, man, we don't want that. We just want jobs," they went crazy. "Yay, we're going to have health care on our parents till they're 26. You know, yeah. Like, he put the young in young adults, believe me.
Absolutely. Cradle to grave, nanny state. Well, in the few seconds we have left, tell everyone where they can get a hold of a copy of your book.
Absolutely. Don't Let the Kids Drink the Kool-Aid.com is the first stop, because you can go and read a free chapter. And then there's a link there, if you like it, to go through and buy it on Amazon, I guess. So either that, or just find me on the web at marybethhicks.com.
Fantastic. Mary Beth, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. I hope you'll come back. I feel like we barely scratched the surface of the book.
Oh, I'd love to come back. Have me get with me anytime. I'd love to come back and chat some more.
Fantastic, Mary Beth. Have a great day.
All right. Thanks so much, Mark. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My next guest is Margaret Hoover. She is the great-granddaughter of Herbert Hoover. She grew up a self-described ditto head. She worked in the White House for George W. Bush, and as I'm sure you well know, she can be seen regularly on Fox News as one of Bill O'Reilly's culture warriors. She's here today to talk to us about her new book, American Individualism. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I think this is your first time on the show, and we are very, very excited to have you here. Now, you talk in the book about what it was like to grow up Hoover. Your great-grandfather has been the recipient of much criticism, most of it undeserved. But even as a little kid, you had to endure people criticizing your great-grandfather, didn't you?
Well, I did, and I, you know, let's be fair. It wasn't like it was, you know, I have a deep loyalty to, as many people do who sort of know the whole story about Herbert Hoover. They really become committed to setting the legacy straight, and that's sort of the effect that it had on me. And you know, it's not like I was beat up in the playground, though my father was. And, you know, that's one of the things to remember, the New Deal and the Great Depression and the Roosevelt era versus the Hoover sort of personal polarization, it was deeply personal against Herbert Hoover and his family. And so the first generation after Herbert Hoover really, really struggled and suffered severe criticisms and, you know, sort of like a scarlet A on their chest for a lot of their lives. And that's just something they carried with them. And so I grew up seeing that. And, of course, you know, my history books taught me in eighth grade when we first did the Great Depression, or seventh grade, that Herbert Hoover caused the Great Depression. And then by the time I had gotten to high school, you know, the AP U.S. history text taught us that, okay, well, he didn't cause the Great Depression, but he sure didn't do anything to fix it. You know, he just sort of was this cold, austere, you know, sort of sat on his hands, didn't do much to fix the problem until FDR came and saved the day with the New Deal. Now, fortunately, that narrative is beginning to be corrected, I think in large part to the book Amity Schles wrote called The Forgotten Man, which really does a lot to blunt and bluff the image that FDR's New Deal really got us out of the Great Depression. Of course, we all know now the economy tanked even worse than in the early 30s in 1937 and 1938 under FDR because the New Deal wasn't working.
Yeah, and when there was also New Deal or Raw Deal, it seems like a number of books have come out that are starting to paint a more accurate picture of that time period. But, you know, one of the sad things about all of the blame that has been heaped on your great-grandfather is that many of the accomplishments that he achieved have been lost in that. Why don't you talk to me, and you did a great job in the book, but talk to me and my listeners about some of the accomplishments of Herbert Hoover that they may not be aware of.
Thank you for giving me a chance to, because it's incredible.
Sure.
I mean, this is a man who his contemporaries called the great humanitarian because his biographers estimate he saved close to 1 billion lives from starvation throughout his life through famine relief efforts in Russia, the Soviet Union. He hated the Bolsheviks, couldn't stand Lenin, but organized food relief between 1921 and 1923. There's actually a great PBS documentary about it called The Great Famine. In 2,900 kitchens across Russia throughout those 3 years, they fed 10 million Russians a day, delivering food relief. And by the way, they had grain from the Midwest sent over so that they could plant new grain, and then they bought corn from all over the Midwest of the United States. And Herbert Hoover forced Lenin to purchase. Because he knew he had the money and he wasn't feeding his own people, so he forced Lenin in a depression in the United States. Because there was a depression in the early 1920s in the United States, which we forget about. Of course, it was much smaller than the Great Depression, but mm-hmm. but he forced the Soviets to use their own money to buy grain from American farmers to feed Russians, and Hoover delivered the food relief. But he did the same thing in the beginning of World War One with the Belgians. When the Belgians were blockaded, 80% of their food came in through imports, and it was blockaded because the English blockaded the German invasion. Herbert Hoover, as an individual, not even as a member of government, he was a private individual American living in London and organized food relief to 8 million Belgians. So he was just, people don't know, Herbert Hoover was the only civilian president ever elected without having been elected to a previous election. So the only election he ever ran for and won was for president. And that just doesn't happen unless you are considered a hero of some sort. So we know there's got to be a story that isn't being told if that's the case. And one of the other stories is the 1927 Mississippi River flood, which was the Hurricane Katrina of its day. And as Secretary of Commerce, he organized relief to all the Midwestern flood states, but had it all paid for through private funds. So the federal government didn't pay for any of the relief. And he was able to get 1.5 million people out of the floodwaters into temporary housing, tent cities with, you know, medical care, education, potable water, food, and you know, millions of livestock were killed in this. And he coordinated with all the local governments and then organized all the relief paid for by private investments.
Well, speaking of achieving things without necessarily going through the government, he's also the reason that a lot of things were standardized. You talked about the size of bricks, street lights, and he was able to achieve this not by ramming legislation down people's throats, but by having conferences and getting the private sector to agree, correct?
Yeah, through voluntary cooperation. He used the press and conferences and his position in government to bring light to the fact that if we standardize a brick size, then industry will be much more efficient. And he believed that there was a unique role that government could play to help industry become more efficient, but he did not believe in shoving legislation down people's throats. He believed that you could get people to voluntarily do it, and that was the method that should be pursued. And this is, by the way, how the Hoover Dam was built. He worked for, you know, basically 8 years with the seven states, all seven western states where, you know, Nevada, Colorado, where all the water was coming from to build the Hoover Dam. And it was through sort of voluntary efforts and negotiations and lots of cooperation that they managed to get the Hoover Dam built. Of course, all of the money was paid back with interest, and it's been privately run and operated. It was a private-public partnership, an early model of this. And this is what FDR threw out the window when FDR took over the presidency during the Great Depression and Muscle Shoals. He took over Muscle Shoals and made it a federal operation rather than a public-private partnership. So Hoover really pioneered that because he believed that the government shouldn't overstep certain bounds. He had a very clear understanding of the relationship between the government, the private sector, the government, and the individual.
Well, speaking of FDR, one of the first things he did in office was cancel your great-grandfather's Secret Service detail. Talk about a slap in the face.
It was very personalized. I mean, this is another thing why I think, you know, Hoover supporters, and it's not just family members, trust me. I mean, people who really know the history find the actions of FDR were really, they were deeply personalized. They were, you know, they were just plain mean in a lot of ways, and they were unpatriotic. And, you know, one of the first people to recognize that and to do something about it was Harry Truman. Because as soon as Harry Truman took the presidency, he reached out to Herbert Hoover because he knew no one could help in the post-war food relief efforts like Hoover. And, in fact, it had been suggested to FDR at the end of the war, and he said, I mean, there's a fabulous quote from his advisors. He said, "I'm not going to be Jesus Christ and raise Hoover from the dead." But Truman, against the will of his advisors, within 30 days of being in the White House, wrote Herbert Hoover a personal letter, invited him to the White House, and said, it would be my honor to become personally acquainted with you. And it was really Harry Truman who righted all the indignities of the FDR era and brought Hoover back into the public light. And Hoover served in a very public capacity for the rest of his life. He served on two congressional commissions and as well also food relief after World War II. So Hoover did get to see his name vindicated a bit towards the end of his life. Although I think there's been a backslide since his passing.
That is one of the great aspects of this book, is just having the record corrected on your great-grandfather. But, of course, the even larger purpose of this book is to discuss the millennials and how the Republican Party has kind of fallen out of step with this generation. Tell my listeners who the millennials are, give us some demographic definitions, and then talk to me about the ways that the Republican Party has fallen out of step with this particular group.
Okay. So, and by the way, the title of the book, the millennials were born, they are 30 and under, basically, if you want to just sort of raw thumbnail sketch of them. They are everybody, I'm 33, so I'm on the cusp. I'm a little bit old to be a millennial, but, you know, generations aren't carved in stone. So I have a lot of sensibilities as a millennial, but I'm technically 3 years too old to be one. And they were born basically at the beginning of the Reagan era, through the end of the Clinton presidency. They are the largest generation in American history. There are 80 million of them total. That's a conservative estimate. Some estimates have it as high as 95 million. That makes them 27 million more of them than Generation X, 17 million more of them than baby boomers. They vote. In 2008, 50 million of them were eligible to vote. Over half of them came to the polls. They were 18% of the electorate. So this is a huge demographic, a huge generation. They are animated. They care about their government. And they could be as much as 65 million will be eligible to vote in 2012. So if they turn out in the same numbers that they did in 2008, they could be as much as 24% of the electorate.
So now, they're the same size as the Tea Party, or the people who support the Tea Party agenda.
Well, the Tea Party agenda is not 30 and under necessarily.
I'm saying the size, the 24%.
The same size, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And there is some synergy, there is some overlap. Now, here's the concern, and the reason I wrote the book is that partisan identity tends to solidify after three presidential election cycles, and so in 2000, the very first millennials showed up to vote. There weren't very many of them. They split their votes evenly between Al Gore and George Bush. There was no decisive partisan break in that election. In 2004, they voted by 9 points for John Kerry. In 2008, they voted by 32 points for Barack Obama. So if Republicans, we have 16 months, basically, almost 16, 15 months to make inroads with this generation, or we could lose them. They'll be voting. They will not self-identify as Republicans for the rest of their lives. So there's a very limited time frame, but we have an opportunity because there are true signs that they've been disappointed with Barack Obama.
That was my next question.
Yeah, they are 37% unemployed or underemployed. I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago about this, and it was how the Republicans can make inroads and get the youth back in the next 15 months. They're not working. Their approval rating of Barack Obama has dropped 18 points since January of 2009. And I believe in Republicans can win the youth vote. We've done it before. Ronald Reagan brought an entire generation of youth into the Republican Party and the conservative movement. He won the youth vote in 1984 by 20 percentage points. This generation, like the Reagan Revolution, younger cohorts tend to react to the failures in government that they know because they aren't as experienced. So the youth in 1980 were reacting against the failures of the Carter administration, and then they embraced the vision that Ronald Reagan laid out for them. Then they came back 4 years later and doubled down, Reagan winning it by 20 percentage points. With Barack Obama, it hurts my heart to say this because it was an honor of a lifetime to work in the White House for President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, the youth started to break from the Republican Party in 2004 because they believed that John Kerry was right when he said Iraq was the wrong war at the wrong place at the wrong time. And then they saw the failures of the bungled government response on every level of Hurricane Katrina, but they blamed Bush for it. And I think the media narrative blamed Bush, and I was intimately involved, by the way, in the government efforts with Hurricane Katrina. I worked in the government at that time.
Margaret,
I will defend the president to the end of the day for that. But the data shows that he broke then.
I will, too, on that particular issue. Now, you mentioned in the book that these people are highly educated and they're on track to be the most educated generation ever. What do they not get about the fact that the mayor, Mayor Nagin of New Orleans, was a Democrat and he was completely incompetent at the time?
Governor Blanco was a
Democrat and she was completely incompetent. And if you read even a small section of Karl Rove's book, Courage and Consequence, you see how hard George Bush and his administration worked to get them to do something.
I was the mayor's and county officials person at the White House at that time. I was the associate director of intergovernmental affairs. I was talking to Nagin on the phone, saying the president's going to call you in 5 minutes. Is this the right number for him to call you? I had a pretty good perch on how involved President Bush was, and I don't think he could have done anything better. He did everything right, especially in those first days. But the truth is, we lost the communications battle. I mean, we just did. And that's the unfortunate truth. So
contrast that, Margaret. Contrast how Bush handled Katrina with how Obama handled the BP oil spill.
Oh, gosh. I mean, look, President Bush was down in the Gulf Coast 7 times in the 7 weeks following it. I mean, we were doing trips. I mean, it takes an enormous amount of coordination from White House staff to do a White House trip. And by the way, communications were down. So the way we were organizing meetings with mayors was through CB radios for every 30 miles through police cars, because that's the only way. Police cars, by the way, the only ones that survived it, because they were able to get out of the tidal wave area before it receded. I mean, look, we were talking to mayors who were sleeping on the foundations of their houses. I mean, the foundations will have their houses and wash away. President Bush was down. He put his governor's hat on, really. I mean, he had been a governor. He dealt with crises like this all the time. He knew how to do it, and he put his governor's hat on, and he was absolutely there pushing Kathleen Blanco to ask for the National Guard, pushing Mayor Nagin to evacuate the city. And the truth is, at the end of the day, it comes down to in those critical moments, first responding moments, it's all about local control and local authority. And there was a dereliction of duty on a local level, and that's why lives were lost. And that is not President Bush's fault.
Somebody told me that Nagin is actually working now as some kind of a disaster consultant or something. I mean, is that a joke?
Yeah, it is a joke. I heard that as well. I don't even know what Mayor Nagin's doing, but. President Bush was deeply involved in it. But look, I don't want to relitigate Katrina. I think President Bush did everything right. But the communications battle was clearly lost in the mainstream narrative. And you know, that's what most Americans, not you and I, because we pay attention closely, but most people, you know, have lots of things that they do and tune in only a little bit. And so it's whatever that mainstream narrative is telling people that they get their news. And so anyway, there was a break of youth from the Republican Party during the Bush years, and that breaks my heart, and that's why I wanted to write the book, because I think the solutions the conservative movement, the Republican Party, have put forward are solutions that not only fit the interests of the millennials better and the sensibilities of the millennials better, but also the policies fit their future better. And I have a chapter called Generational Theft, because the spending policies of this government are policies that are compromising my future and the future of everybody younger than us. Every dollar that's spent, you know, it's on us to pay back with interest. And if we don't correct the course of spending, we're going to be paying it back in the form of higher taxes or a worse economy or both. And that is something that the millennial generation is starting to wake up to. You'd be surprised at the number of websites that are run by 30 and unders. You know, there's one called WeCan'tPayThatTab.org. The reason I think Ron Paul is getting so much traction is not his neo-isolationism message. It is the fiscal message. And not many people are talking about the fact that, you know, he came in second in the Ames straw poll, and that was because of youth. You know, that was because of young people. Yeah, I mean, he had hordes of young people. I was at Fox News yesterday because I had O'Reilly, and there were swarms of young people outside Fox News with Ron Paul signs. He's really tapping into an energy that youth have about fiscal responsibility, and that is synergistic with the Tea Party message, absolutely.
But it's also an anti-war message that also resonates well with the youth.
You know what? It certainly did in 08. But that is not what's motivating them right now. It's fiscal issues. I talked to a guy who runs concerts. He registers people to vote at concerts. Now, you may think this is a good idea or not, but what he's seeing on the signs is all fiscal messages for Ron Paul. It's not war stuff that's motivating people right now across. So that's just the sense that's out there. I think, too, this is a generation that, as they're characterized, they're very altruistic. They're the 9/11 generation, remember. So they saw the country get hit hard, but they also saw the country pull itself up from its bootstraps. And they honor public service. They think about how the heroes of 9/11 were the firefighters, police officers, and Port Authority officers who charged into the buildings to get people out. They grew up with a sense of that. You know, it's hard for conservatives to get our heads around this, but they don't believe government's evil. They actually think government can be made to work. And that's something that is counterintuitive for conservatives, but if we know that about the millennials, then I think we can still make a case for our policies with them without indemnifying government. I think Paul Ryan does a great job of this, by the way. You know, he says Barack Obama's policies are bad, but he doesn't vilify Barack Obama personally. And that's just a distinction that is really important if we're going to get, you know, if we're going to get to them. Otherwise, they'll tune us out.
Now, one of the things that I want to ask you specifically is, though, what can the Republican do to get the millennials over into our camp? What are the hot button issues for the millennials?
I think absolutely fiscal policy is generational theft. I think we have to connect spending to them and the youth, because we're compromising. The spending now compromises their fiscal future and the economic prosperity of them when they're growing up, when they have kids, and when they have grandkids. And that, we just you have to personalize it. You have to absolutely connect the dots. Another hot button issue for them is education. They understand that the education system in this country is subpar, that we've been spending 40% more than the countries who are also in the OECD, the top other top industrialized countries, and getting results that are substantially worse for 20, 30, 40 years. So they know there's a systemic problem. And this is a generation, by the way, that has staffed the charter school movement. They have staffed the Teach for America movement. They want to serve, they want to help, they want to, you know, be part of something larger than themselves. And I think they're starting to get that the unions are the problem. And I think we can make a very strong case, because it's there. All we have to do is connect the dots. All the places where major education reform is happening in this country, serious education reform, LIFO reform, teacher tenure, collective bargaining in education, are in states with Republican governors and Republican legislators. And all we have to do is connect the dots, because this is also the most diverse generation in American history. They are 40% non-white. And the fact that 30% of millennials aren't graduating from high school and the overwhelming majority of them are minorities is just doesn't sit right with them, which is, I think, why they want to be part of the solution and why so many of them are teaching after school for a few years, dedicating themselves to community service. And I think we have a wonderful story in the conservative movement to tell about how to fix. And by the way, we're the only ones who can fix it, because our hands aren't tied by teachers' union money. It's the largest special interest in politics. I mean, the teachers' unions give more than the NRA, Big Pharma, any of these other special interests combined. So the story is there. We just need to connect the dots and make the case for them, because it's an issue they care about. And then there are other issues, I think, where we can make a very strong case, but we're going to have to think about how we communicate it. They care a lot about the environment. Mm-hmm. And they need to punch back. I think we can make a case for a conservative environmentalism that is also pro-market, so that you know, we can be environmentalists. We can be for conserving the environment without embracing these left-wing solutions that would put enormous regulatory burdens and tax burdens on the middle class. This cap and trade, which would really, you know, cap and tax, as the Republicans rightly called it, which would have put an enormous regulatory burden on the middle class, would have amounted to massive consumption tax for the middle class on energy costs. Energy costs would have spiked. I mean, we need to punch back on this notion that you have to, in order to be an environmentalist, you have to be for that.
Well, let me start the punching back right now, because I am not a big fan of anthropogenic global warming. I actually mentioned this with my previous guest this morning, Mary Beth Hicks, and that may be an area where we differ. But mm-hmm. I drive a hybrid, okay?
Right.
I plant trees with my son. If you drive through the downtown area of our community, you'll see about a dozen to 18 trees that my son and I personally planted.
That's
in the
right.
downtown area. We recycle our aluminum. We try not to waste water.
You're a conservative environmentalist.
Absolutely. But I'm going to be honest with you. I don't buy into the anthropogenic global warming thing. I've spent about 3 years researching it, and I think that there's no reason for concern there. And I would like to see environmentalism pushed because it's what's right, okay?
Yeah,
clean water,
absolutely.
Clean air, that's what's right. Now, mm-hmm. I can tell you that, having researched this extensively, and I've had a lot of the world's biggest skeptics on global warming on my show, that there really is a cause for concern. This is being caused by solar cycles. And when I talk to young people, as I do frequently, I will tell them, do you realize that CO2 is so beneficial to plants that commercial greenhouses pump it in because of the benefits to the plants? And
right.
they'll go, no,
right.
I didn't hear that. Do you know that we breathe out CO2? And many of them don't even get the difference between the carbon monoxide, which comes out of the tailpipe of our car and is poisonous, and carbon dioxide.
Right.
Yeah, and then when you talk to him about the fact that the other planets are going through went through a similar warming period, and that they don't have jet planes and cars circling their planet, but yet they experienced the same heat increase that we did, which means it was probably caused by a solar cycle. They just sort of give you that deer in the headlights look. So I think there's a lot, because there's a lot of brainwashing, and again, Mary Beth and I just talked about that, but there's a lot of brainwashing in the schools. But I think that here's the biggest mistake I think the Republican Party is making, or the conservatives and Tea Partiers are making, and I'd like your opinion on this. I don't think we give the kids who are environmentally conscious another place to go.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree with you more. I didn't mean to cut you off. You just got my enthusiasm. That's why we have to provide an alternative.
I mean, I thought about trying to start a group called True Green. Now, here's what bothers me, is that we're spending billions. I think there was $6 billion to study global warming in the last stimulus package. And we're spending all this money to worry about a problem that doesn't even exist. And as Bjorn Lomborg pointed out in his book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, if we took that money now and applied it to immediate solutions regarding pollution and, you know, clean air, clean water,
absolutely,
planting more trees, it would do so much more good for the environment. And the kids don't understand that as conservatives, we're not saying we don't care about the environment. We're saying let's put the money in the right areas.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I cite Bjorn Lomborg in my conservative environmentalist chapter because I think he has the most pragmatic solutions for approaching the environment, and that's exactly right. I mean, he says for the amount of money that we put into sort of global warming efforts, we could solve the potable water problem in Africa, and people wouldn't be dying in Africa because they don't have clean water or running water. I mean, you could solve it because I couldn't agree with you more on Bjorn, his solutions and his approach. And I also couldn't agree with you more on the fact that as conservatives, I think we can put forth a conservative environmentalist agenda, which will give the kids somewhere else to go, a counterpoint. And it just means doing it. I mean, we just need to put ideas forward, and it's not like we don't have the ideas. And so my hope is that my book will be a little bit of a roadmap for whoever the candidate is, that they'll look at this and say, okay, we can have a conservative environmentalist agenda. We can, because the reality is most people in America tune in every 4 years. Once there's a nominee, you know, they're not paying attention to this primary process as closely as I am or you are or your listeners are. They'll tune in, you know, next summer once there's a nominee. And there will be a good 4 months for the Republican nominee to make his or her case, whoever it is. And I hope that our candidate, and I have confidence that our candidates will do this, will use the opportunity to build a new platform on some of these issues that haven't necessarily been, that have been sort of outcast as not conservative issues. What are the other ones? I think, you know, immigration. I think we have a wonderful case to make on immigration reform, which is you have to be able to explain that we can't do anything, Democrats or Republicans, until we secure the borders and we have real benchmarks that we can hit. And we have wonderful new faces to make this case. Marco Rubio, Susana Martinez, who is a Hispanic Republican governor of New Mexico, a border state. Mm-hmm. Same with Brian Sandoval, Hispanic Republican governor of another border state next door, Nevada. I mean, these are the people who need to be explaining. And millennials understand. If you pull them, 59% of them say they understand the need for a country to secure its borders. So that's where you start.
Well, again, the conservative position, and, you know, I have people hit me all the time with, you know, you're a Tea Partier, you hate immigrants. And what I try to point out is that we don't hate immigrants, and in fact, we support legal immigration. That's what made this country great. Half my family is from Czechoslovakia, the other half is from Palermo, Sicily. And that's what made this country absolutely great, is the diversity because of the immigration from all parts of the world. However, we can't have a 100% porous border. We can't have people coming across who haven't gone through the legal channels. I mean, I know a guy from Great Britain who's been trying to get a citizenship for the last 4 years, and it's not fair for him to be told you have to go through legal channels, but then tell people from Mexico or South America, well, because of your proximity to the United States, we're just going to let you walk across. I mean, one, it doesn't work because we're going to overload our welfare system, because when people come over, they often don't have jobs. And secondly, it's just an absolute disgrace and a slap in the face to people who went through the trouble of doing it the right way.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And the truth is, you know, the Democrats have been very very effective at demagoguing Republicans on this. And I think, you know, the millennials, they want pragmatic solutions. They don't like demagoguery. They turn off partisan talking points. You know, I think the key to making the case for millennials is making a reasoned case. And I think we have wonderful, articulate, thoughtful people who can do that, who can make that case to them, that legal immigration and border security have got to be the starting point. And you know, Marco Rubio, I start off my immigration chapter with a quote from Marco Rubio. He said, "The Republican Party, unfortunately, has been cast as the anti-illegal immigration party. It is not the anti-illegal immigration party. It is the pro-legal immigration party." And
yeah.
Having a legal immigration system that works begins with border security.
Well, now, one of the things I want to ask you, we made a brief reference at the beginning of the interview to the fact that a lot of the millennials are disappointed in Barack Obama. Let's take a look at a lot of the things that he's fallen short on, perhaps in their eyes. He said he was going to close Guantanamo Bay, Gitmo. He didn't do it. He criticized the Bush tax cuts when he was a candidate, but extended them as a president. You know, he has dropped bombs on Libya. He escalated the war in Afghanistan. And there are a lot of them who are saying, hey, this isn't really what I signed up for.
Yeah, but he also, those are some issues. Look, I give him credit for doing the right thing in Afghanistan. So I think some of the things I'm glad he didn't close Guantanamo. I give him credit for that.
Right.
He
extended the Patriot Act. He criticized
So actually, on some of these national security issues, he's done way better than I would have thought. I don't want to litigate that, because I don't want the kids. You know, I want the kids to know that, you know, there was a responsible reason for him not to close Guantanamo. And that he was wrong in the first place. But where they've really, I think one of the main areas where they've been disappointed is that he promised no red states, no blue states, but the United States of America. He promised that we would be able to get past our partisan differences. He has been, look, no president can get us past our partisan differences. George Bush wanted to do the same thing. But the problem with Barack Obama is that he has contributed to the egging on. He has contributed to the demagoguery. He has contributed to the ill will and to the entrenched partisanship on both sides by demagoguing Paul Ryan, by not, you know, remember when he didn't even put a real reform package through for entitlements, and then Paul Ryan did, and he gave a speech the next day, and Paul Ryan's, you know, a political speech that couldn't even be scored by CBO, saying he had a plan. You know, so he's done these things. You know, he goes down to the border and says Republicans want to build a moat and put alligators in it. You know, he's done all this sort of demagoguery, which is, that, I mean, that's what the millennials were hoping we'd be able to get beyond. And I think a lot of his tonality, he promised a tone and a tenor that he hasn't been able to deliver upon.
So you mean when he said, if they bring a knife, we'll bring a gun, that wasn't bringing red and blue together?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But look, that was part of what spoke to the ethos of this generation. It really did. I mean, millennials are, they're pragmatists. They want government to work. They want people to make it work. And, you know, they genuinely feel if you're in the government and you can't make it work, get out. We want somebody who can make it work. And that's one thing that he's failed on the tone, he's failed on the tenor, and he's failed to make it work.
One of the things you mentioned in the book, but you haven't brought up yet, and I'm afraid it's one of those areas where hardcore conservatives and the millennials are never going to agree, is the issue of gay marriage. Do you think that we should just put aside the social issues for now and focus on fiscal?
Yes. Rick Perry said we should focus on, you know, we should go 10th Amendment. Let states decide what states want to do, and I think that's a great meeting point for now, because the truth is the millennials are, there are now six national polls that show a majority of Americans are in favor of freedom to marry, and the millennials are overwhelming, they're the only generation that's overwhelmingly in favor of this. They're not going to change their minds when they get older. There is a change. I mean, if you poll nationally, every age cohort, do you think eventually freedom to marry will be something that is accepted broadly? Everybody agrees that it's sort of inevitable. So I just think planting the flag in the sand against this issue is not a way to get to the millennials' hearts. And I don't think they're – but look, Democrats aren't in favor of it either. I mean, Barack Obama's not in favor of it either. And in many ways, you know, Dick Cheney, who is – nobody would question – Vice President Cheney's conservative credentials, and Dick Cheney is in favor of freedom to marry. So I just don't think this should be an issue that divides the party. I think we should focus on what unites us, not what divides us.
Well, one of the things you said about the millennials is that they're about a third minority. It was that minority vote in California that sort of wrecked the plans for gay marriage being legal there.
It was African American churches, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you know what? The if you took a vote in California right now, it'd win. And the truth is, I think it was that vote. It was really a religious vote in 2008. People there were, you know, churches were really motivated to get out and vote, and it wasn't seen as much as a issue of individual liberty or individual freedom. I think you know, people started thinking about it more since then, and I think people think, let individuals make choices for themselves. The government shouldn't be telling them how to live their lives.
Well, you said the vote wouldn't turn out the same way right now in California. I bet if you did it again in 2012, it would, because the same churches that came out and supported Barack Obama in 2008 are going to be back out again.
Yeah, no, I don't know. There have been a lot of polls recently that I follow pretty closely because I'm on the advisory council of this Ted Olson's trial, which is litigating the constitutionality of that court decision.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Ted Olson, of course, was the Solicitor General under George W. Bush, and he's one of the founders of the Federalist Society. He's, you know, a real constitutional conservative, and also was the reason, you know, Bush Gore ultimately won, President Bush won the Supreme Court case that ultimately got him into the White House, because Ted Olson argued that case. He's argued 55 cases before the Supreme Court and won 45 of them. And that case now shows definitively that Californians are in support of freedom to marry. So it was a 5-point difference in 2008 in the votes, and now there it shows there's a 5-point majority in favor of it. So I think if there was a vote, we'd have to see, but it does seem that the waves have shifted.
Well, what's interesting is I know several conservatives. In fact, I have several conservative friends who are gay, and they tell me they don't want to get married. They do believe
that's their choice. That's absolutely their choice. But the question is, you know, is it a freedom that is guaranteed in the Constitution? And that's what's the question here, at least before the courts.
Well, I have several thoughts. I'm fine with civil unions. I have a position that's very similar to Barack Obama's, or at least what it was when he was first asked. And I'm fine with civil unions. But at the same time, I mean, a marriage has always been defined as a union between a man and a woman. I don't understand why homosexuals want to be married, other than the fact that heterosexuals are getting to do it and they've been told that they can't.
But isn't that, you know, there's something socially significant about marriage. I mean, there just is, right? There's something special about it. And what you do is when you say to one class of citizens, you can sit here, and another class of citizens, you can sit here. Or, you know, you can have these freedoms, but you can't have these freedoms. You're creating a second class of citizens. And that, the Supreme Court, the Constitution of the United States has decided is separate but equal. And we've decided also that separate but equal doesn't work, because separate is never equal. And I when you just look on a pragmatic issue, you know, I have a lesbian couple who's getting married that lives down the street, and mm-hmm. I'm married. I was married in California, and, you know, I know that my husband and I's marriage is not going to be at all changed by the fact that my girlfriend and her fiancé are going to get married. And I don't think it's going to harm or damage the institution of marriage. In fact, I think our society and our culture is made stronger by people who decide to commit themselves for their entire life in a sacred bond of marriage. That makes the fabric of our society stronger. It makes people rely on one another, not the government. And I think America needs more marriages, not less. I mean, I think what has been more damaging to the institution of marriage is no-fault divorce. I don't think two gay people getting married is going to hurt my marriage or the institution of marriage.
Well, a lot of people would argue that if God wanted to see these unions between people of the same sex, you know, we wouldn't be in a situation where only men and women can reproduce. That obviously this isn't the natural way things were intended by God. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I agree with that. But look, we've decided that marriage in this country is it's religious and it's civil. And the question is just, are we going to allow civil marriages? You know, we allow prisoners to get married. Prisoners can't reproduce. We allow all sorts
they can't?
Of people to get I mean,
have you ever heard of conjugal
prison
visits?
Cells.
They have conjugal visits. They can reproduce. Come on, Margaret.
But the idea isn't for prisoners to reproduce. I mean, but the Constitution, the Supreme Court of the United States in Turner versus Safely in 1987 said prisoners have a constitutional right to be able to get married. You're telling me that legal, law-abiding gays and lesbians don't have a constitutional right to get married, but prisoners who are locked up in prison cells for murder have a right, a constitutional right to get married, but gays and lesbians don't?
I have two thoughts on that. One is I loved it when Kinky Friedman said, I think gay people have as much a right to be miserable as anybody else. And let them experience. You really think you want to get married? You might change your mind. And I'm just kidding. I've been married for 25 years. I'm very, very happily married. And if my wife is listening, I've got some real explaining to do. But at the same time, too, the other thing is, this is going to sound really bad, and I've actually told some of my gay friends this. So if you're gay and you're listening, please don't write in. This is a joke. I'll tell you in advance. But I've always wanted to grant them marriage just to see what in the heck they're going to ask for next. I mean, because I just like to snap my fingers. We want gay marriage. Done. Now what do you want? Because I mean, I think it was Bill O'Reilly who once said that gay people aren't happy with you just saying, hey, you can do whatever you want to in the privacy of your own bedroom. They want to flaunt their sexuality, and they want to demand that you approve of it. They want you to bless it. They want you to condone it.
I don't think most gay people want to flaunt their sexuality any more than you and I want to flaunt their sexuality. I do all the time, actually. I saw him last night. Most gay people are just as level-headed as you and me. And of course, you know, there was a time, just sort of like there was a radical feminist movement. There was also sort of an extremist gay rights movement one of my favorite Onion. The Onion. The satirical, you know, it was like the favorite headline from the Onion one time was, until I went to the gay pride parade, I thought gay people were just like you and me. and the notion was that, you know, these radicals in this movement have really have had a negative effect on people's perception of gay freedoms. But the reality is, especially for the millennial generation, you know, like, this is just not an issue they think about, because sexual orientation is just one of many characteristics that make people who they are. And, at the end of the day, they want their gay friends to have the same freedoms they're going to have.
Well, they have a lot of legal rights already. I mean, much of corporate America grants insurance benefits and numerous other benefits to same-sex partners. And, you know, this
more
is just
than half of states don't have non-discrimination laws. There are 29 states that don't have non-discrimination laws for gays and lesbians. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to be done for gay freedoms. And I think I think the country's moving in the right direction on that. I mean, that's my opinion. I think it is the right direction to move towards non-discrimination laws, I think. But there's a ways to go. But this is just not something that the Republican Party should plant their flag in the sand against. Because it's, you know, we're on the wrong side of history. That would be being
a lot of Tea Partiers, and I haven't been elected to speak for the Tea Party, but I think a lot of Tea Partiers feel like, you know what, I'm fine. Have your rights. You know, I'm not trying to interfere with somebody else's rights, but I don't want to be seen as endorsing homosexuality. And that's the take I'm getting on a lot of the Tea Partiers.
Yeah, and that may be fine. But that's an easy meeting point, right? So let's focus on fiscal issues. That's what's important. But you know, nobody's asking. I'm just saying I'm saying where the millennials are, and the millennials are just not seeing this as a sticking point. And if the Republicans are going to plant their flag in the sand against gay freedoms, the freedoms of their gay friends, they're going to have a harder time reaching this generation. Period.
Okay. What percentage of Americans do you think gay people make up?
You know what? I have no idea. I know that there are a lot of science, you know, scientific studies that say, you know, 2-4%. You know.
Right. Right.
But I don't actually know the answer to that.
I guess I'm asking, is this much ado about nothing considering?
I believe that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence guarantee freedom for everyone, regardless of your sexual orientation.
Right. Of course, then you can ask the question, when did marriage become a right?
No, it's not a right. Look, the Supreme Court, 14 times since 1888, has said that marriage is a fundamental right, the same as freedom of assembly, freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom to carry a gun. These are all fundamental rights in the Constitution, and 14 times since 1888, the Supreme Court has ruled on marriage that it is a fundamental right. So there's simply a precedent that the Supreme Court has set that says that that there should be freedoms for all citizens on marriage.
Margaret, with the time we have left, tell our listeners how they can get a copy of your book.
Thank you. I would see Amazon, your local bookstore, or margarethoover.com.
Okay, and we're gonna put it up on our website as well, which is teapartypowerhour.com, and we will make sure that people can find it through there, and our link is going to go directly to Amazon as well. So any one of the links that Margaret just mentioned, or you can go through our website. I think it's a great book, one for giving Republicans some idea as to how we can capture the millennial generation vote in the next election. And I got to be honest with you, I equally enjoyed you setting the record straight on your great-grandfather. I thought that was a marvelous section of the book as well. It's almost like two books in one, and I think I know that my Tea Party listeners are going to enjoy this book. So pick up a copy of it as soon as you can. I know you're going to like it. Margaret, we are almost out of time. I just want to thank you for being here today. Thanks for putting up with some of my questions. And I hope I haven't scared you off and that you'd be willing to come back someday.
Absolutely. Would love to come back.
And that's all we have time for today on the Tea Party Power Hour. Join me next time when my guest will be Newt Gingrich. He'll be here to talk to us about his book, A Nation Like No Other, Why American Exceptionalism Matters.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.